Hey everybody, it's Pastor Brian Ross from Grace Life Bible Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We want to welcome you to this video, as well as to our YouTube channel here. If you haven't already done so, if you would consider subscribing and ringing the alarm bell as a way of staying current with the ministry when we go live from our assembly building, as well as when we create content for you here midweek, we'd certainly appreciate that. Also want to remind you about our Rumble channel here, Grace Life Bible Church on Rumble. We established this as an alt-text site. Should something happen to our YouTube ministry, so if you're into alt-text sites, or like an alternative to YouTube, please consider checking us out here on Rumble as well. My featured books this week are once again my co-authored book, J.C. O'Hare and the Origins of the American Grace Movement, 1899 to 1958. I co-authored this with my former professor, Dr. Dale DeWitt. This is a full-length featured church history book covering the development of mid-Acts dispensationalism in the American fundamentalist movement in the 1930s. So if you're into the history of dispensationalism or the history of religious thought here in the United States, you're definitely going to want to pick up a copy of this book and check it out. Also, my second feature is my book, Rightly Dividing E.W. Bullinger, Assessing His Life, Ministry, and Impact. This book has a sketch of Bullinger's life with a main focus. The main contribution of the book is to trace the historical development of the Acts 28 dispensational position in the writings and life of E.W. Bullinger. So if you are into the history of dispensationalism and want to know more about two key and important figures, pick up the O'Hare book and consider picking up the book here on Bullinger as a way of supporting the ministry. We would certainly appreciate that. Those of you who have been following the channel, you know that we've been working towards ending our analysis of the rise and fall of dispensationalism, how the evangelical battle over the end times shaped the nation, and this was released in May of this year, 2023, by Daniel G. Hummel. And so we've been going through the book here since the early spring, I suppose. Had a couple breaks in there for some other reasons, but I'm trying to finish this analysis up before the end of 2023. So where we find ourselves right now in that analysis, we can look at the preview here from Google Books, is we are right here, we are in section or part three, the pop dispensationalists. We just covered pop dispensationalism in the previous video, so we're on chapter 13, the Great Rupture. As always, there is a bit of an introduction to each chapter, and then this one has three subsections. Wolverine and Ryrie oversee the scholastic shift, George Eldon Ladd and premillennialism without dispensationalism, and dispensationalism after fundamentalism is the main breakdown of this particular chapter. So let's get right into things here. I'm reading from page 249. Actually, I'm reading from page 250. Not a lot this time from the introduction of this chapter, but a couple key points that we want to make sure that we highlight. Okay. So Hummel opened the chapter talking about a prophecy conference from the late 1960s. And how there was representation at this conference from a wide swath of fundamentalist and evangelical groups and positions. Dispensationalism was represented there. And he's kind of coming to an end of this conversation. He says on page 250, the Jerusalem Conference on Prophecy is typically cited by historians as an early example of Christian Zionist organizing. However, the array of voices ensured that the gathering amounted to little more than a sideshow Henry predicted, and that would be Carl F. Henry. The theological divisions evident in Jerusalem exposed a broader crisis of theological authority and fundamentalism. In the 1970s, even as pop dispensationalism reached millions of Americans, the project of scholastic dispensationalism began to crumble, and the leadership of dispensational theology soon slipped beyond the control of its scholastic stalwarts. The cultural authority accrued by Dallas Seminary and others slowly drained away to media empires of pop dispensationalists. Although accelerated by popularizers like Hal Lindsey, the rupture of fundamentalist theology also took place among the theologians. At sites like the BM UMA, as Jerusalem gathering made clear, the growing success of pop dispensationalism had stimulated a theological opposition to dispensationalism like never before. So, in other words, the pop the covenantalists and others look at the success of Hal Lindsey's book and pop dispensationalism and they really start to disdain dispensational theology as a result, even more than they had before. Critics from across the conservative spectrum found common cause in stemming the tide of pop dispensational culture. Judged by book sales and accumulated wealth, dispensational eschatology hardly suffered in the 1970s. And yet scholastic dispensationalism witnessed dramatic, devastating, and permanent setbacks in the same years. So what Hummel is saying is that the scholastic dispensationalism of Dallas Seminary is going to suffer greatly in the 1970s, while pop dispensationalism is going to like really take off like a rocket after the publication of Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey in 1970. The complex ecosystem that made scholastic dispensationalism flourish in the 1950s, a network of interdependent seminaries, publishing houses, churches, and preachers, was remaking itself in the 1970s along the lines of post-war consumer republic and a popularizing political culture. So that brings us into the first subsection. Wolvern and Ryrie oversee the scholastic shift. Okay. So, also important to the rising apocalyptic interest of scholastics was the lodestar of dispensational prophecy that now seemed to have reappeared in the history as the State of Israel in 1948. Post-war scholastics leaned into the unfolding future centered in the Middle East, careening towards cosmic and mired in terrestrial war. Biblical prophecy was silent on the United States, but what it told us about the Jewish people filled volumes of dispensational analysis. Commentaries on the Minor Prophets and texts on systematic theology, the building blocks of the scholastic project, would no longer suffice, especially after the Arab-Israeli War in June 1967. The shift in scholastic style and focus toward the apocalyptic, during the 1960s created a burst in production that on the surface appeared like any other wave of scholastic output. John F. Wahlberg's trilogy, Israel and Prophecy, 1962, The Church and Prophecy, 1964, and The Nations and Prophecy, 1967, was a comprehensive restatement of dispensational eschatology for a new generation. While Charles Feinberg's editorship of the Congress of Prophecy volumes, 1964 and 1968, brought dispensational theology directly to bear on the State of Israel. More visible than the monographs was the completion of the decade-long project in 1967, the Schofield Reference Bible. A committee of 9 dispensational theologians systematized Schofield notes to conform them to the most up-to-date dispensational thinking, which inevitably meant thousands of small and few minor alterations. Now, this is a big deal. The new Schofield Reference Bible is not the same as the old Schofield Reference Bible, and it is specifically amended in places where the Southern Presbyterian Convention and Convocation declared dispensational theology to be heresy. And so many of the places that are specifically identified in the old Schofield Reference Bible as being heretical are updated now in the new Schofield Reference Bible. I talk about this in the Grace History Project. I can't remember which lesson it is. I think it's the lesson on the the dispensational covenantal drift, or rift, I should say, lesson. I think I included that link. Maybe I'll do so again in the description for this video. The most lasting contribution from the decade may have been Charles Ryrie's Dispensationalism Today, 1965. A concise synthesis of the scholastic dispensational system that served as its most cogent summation to date. Ryrie endeavored to provide a quote sine qua non of dispensationalism to clarify its contribution to Christian theology and to do so in a way that painted it as the embodiment of a historical Christian tradition. Philip Marlowe's indictment of dispensationalism as modern appeared on the third page of chapter 1 and haunted Ryrie's apology. His choice of distinctiveness was unsurprising. The essence of dispensationalism, he began, is the distinction between Israel and the church. Two more followed from the first. Plain hermeneutics applied equally to every book in the Bible and an argument that the overall point of history was to glorify God. The third point, Ryrie admitted, was a rather technical matter that concern a more obscure debate with covenantal theology. At the same time, a chapter later was devoted to distinguishing the mainstream of dispensationalism from ultra-dispensationalism, the smaller tradition rooted in the teachings of E.W. Bullinger that rejected water baptism, and in some cases the Eucharist, on a different understanding of dispensational time. So that's where Bullinger comes in and why he's important, and also why O'Hare is important, okay? Hummel doesn't really deal with any of the, he doesn't deal with mid-ex dispensationalism in the book, and he never really deals very thoroughly with Bullingerism or Acts 28 dispensationalism in the book, other than to say that the scholastics and the mainstream of fundamentalism considered Bullingerism to be ultra or hyper dispensationalism, okay? The New Schofield Reference Bible and dispensationalism today signaled the full maturation of scholastic dispensationalism as a theological system in the late 1960s. Moreover, both cemented a modest shift in doctrinal teaching, amounting in some circles of fundamentalism to a level of revision on the new premillennial dualism of Darby and Schofield and earlier efforts at systematization by Schaefer. The revision entailed a shift toward literal hermeneutics rather than a priori dualism as the foundation of dispensational thinking. The change was subtle and went unnoticed by many practitioners and was discussed rarely outside of select academic venues like Bibliotheca Sacra, which is the Journal of Dallas. But the shifting nevertheless indicated changes that would have larger effects in later decades. Then he gets in here to some other folks who are going to be graduates of Dallas Seminary, who are going to be influential. He mentioned Zane Hodges, a professor of the New Testament. Hodges is very instrumental in the formation of the majority text in the early 1980s. Dispensationalism, now producing a steady stream of trained theologians, was fostering something of a fully-fledged scholarly discourse. The theological network generated new insights and addressed new challenges, and for seminarians being trained in the system, the same schools supplied confidence in dispensationalism's academic bona fides credentials. But even as the scholastic conversation grew, dispensational theologians took note of the mass audiences interested in prophecy, with bestsellers by Salem Kirban and Hal Lindsey, financial and cultural capital was up for grabs. Okay, so then he's going to get into how Walvoord and some of these guys are going to enter into this sort of prophecy apocalyptic fray. This shift, now I'm on page 255, the shift changed more dramatically after Lindsey proved to be a vast popular market. The most notable scholastic entry into popular prophecy commentary was John F. Walvoord's, Armageddon, Oil, and the Middle East Crisis, What the Bible Says About the Future of the Middle East and the End of Western Civilization, from 1974. What the work lacked in style, it made up for in cutting-edge analysis. Walvoord discussed Cold War geopolitics, the global oil market, the Arab-Israeli conflict, the European economic integration. The manuscript was only half finished at the outbreak of the Fourth Israeli War in October 1973, with Zondervan once again poised to benefit from a timely entry into the geopolitical prophecy analysis. The press encouraged him to finish it quickly, which he did by conscripting as co-author his son, John E. Walvoord, then a doctoral student in psychology at Columbia University. The final book was released mere months after the dust had settled in the Middle East and made the case that the region was, quote, the center of world attention of prophecies for the last days. Stripped of its prophetic language and episodic digressions into biblical interpretation, Walvoord's tract would have been hard to distinguish from a conservative policy brief echoing the same concerns over weak U.S. diplomacy, high oil prices, and increasing Russian meddling voiced by conservative policy wonks. Walvoord offered more details than Lindsey, and his book achieved impressive sales, 600,000 copies by 1976, and a reissue in 1991 on the eve of the first Gulf War sold another million. But as decade shaping work, the Walrus attempt came up short. Its sales, while large, were dwarfed by the more popular works. The book was an impressive imitator of late great Planet Earth, but an imitator all the same. Armageddon, Oil, and the Middle East was also the most successful of a rash of similar outputs by scholastic dispensationalists. In each case, writers presented a more accessible writing style, vocabulary, and fluency with contemporary affairs. The book ignored systematic doctrine, lending credence to the popular image of dispensationalism as little more than an end-time scenario. Other scholarly popularizations, including retired Dallas Seminary archaeologist Merle Unger's Beyond the Crystal Ball, 1973, Western Seminary biblical scholar Stanley A. Ellison's Biography of a Great Planet, 1975, and Charles Ryrie's The Living End, 1976. All of these contributions hinted at how the center of dispensational thinking was shifting definitively from the seminary to the sales charts, influencing not only who defined dispensational content, but also who shaped its future. Lindsay had shed the scholasticism of his teachers. As those same teachers worked to emulate Lindsay, they were unable to grasp just how thin the barrier separating the old scholastic and the new pop dispensationalism was. So that's the end of that subsection. So a lot of interesting things there. What Hummel is suggesting is that in the 1970s, after the success of Late Great Planet Earth, that the scholastic, the pioneers, the architects of scholastic dispensationalism try to enter into pop dispensationalism with less success than Hal Lindsey did. So that brings us then to subsection two, George Eldon Land and Premillennialism Without Dispensationalism. Page 256. After the 1970s, interest in dispensationalism began to decline within mainstream conservative evangelicalism. He lamented in the foreword to the Scholastic Collaboration Dictionary of Premillennial Theology, 1996, and that was a book by Mel Koch. Okay. Koch's explanations for decline were manifold, but the main thrust could be traced back to the 1970s. Hyped predictions by dispensational writers failed to materialize, and the Middle East geopolitics became less newsworthy by 1973. Koch provided, I have this book, by the way, it's somewhere on my shelf, A Dictionary of Premillennial Theology. Yeah, it's published by Kriegel. Let's see here, 256 still. Underlying this self-serving complaint was a nugget of truth. Dispensational theology as a whole, if it could still be called a whole, was awash in money, but shallow in rigor. For whatever reason, younger evangelicals and fundamentalists lacked the interest to ponder the depths of scholastic dispensationalism. From Koch's perspective, the most galling failures were unforced errors by dispensational seminaries, Bible schools, and pastors, a de-emphasis on teaching the rapture and Bible prophecy in general among once strong churches signaled an alarming paradigm shift, he warned. Prophecy was out, psychology was in. The teaching of doctrine was replaced by sermons on current social issues and the emotional life of the believer, and it could be added political commentary masquerading as prophecy analysis. Mirroring the therapeutic turn in American society that privileged individual self-expression and psychological categories of meaning, evangelical culture after the mid-1970s also became dominated by social and psychological concerns. I have to agree with that, okay? It's hard to disagree with what Koch is saying, okay? Self-help books and family values, two sides of the new interest in personal fulfillment, had replaced grand cosmic reflections on the return of Jesus with concerts closer to and inside the home. This was the scholastic's theory of decline, at least. Koch failed, though, to see that much of the tendencies he abhorred had manifested themselves within scholastic circles. One dispensational pioneer of the move to social and emotional issues was a contributor for the dictionary, who had used the attention accrued from apocalyptic analysis in the 1970s to emerge as a key voice of the culture wars in the 1980s, and that would be Tim LaHaye. Tim LaHaye, after his 1972 discourse on the approaching end, teamed up with his wife Beverly to produce the most popular evangelical sex manual of the decade, The Act of Marriage, 1976. He buttressed this book with help guides on depression, dating advice, and the male temperament that combined to fix his attention on issues of gender and sexuality over all other considerations, marshaling fundamentalists and evangelicals to organize political action in books such as The Battle for the Family, 1982. LaHaye's decade-long publication, Migration from Prophecy Analysis to Social Concerns, fit Couch's narrative on dispensational decline, even though Tim LaHaye would co-write the Left Behind novels in the 1990s. The paradoxical legacy of a figure like LaHaye is at the heart of the rupture of dispensationalism. Many of the tradition's chief proponents in the 1970s pushed into new cultural territory, but did not invest in the preparation of perpetuation of scholastic dispensationalism. Whether that territory was mass culture or mass politics, and LaHaye successfully went toward both, dispensational theology was treated as a source book or an inherent cultural language rather than an active theological tradition require methods of self-perpetuation. Judged on its own terms, dispensational resources of time, energy, and money were all heading away from the scholastic project into newly organized and scaled culture and political projects from mass market thriller novels to political activism. Now, I was a young kid. I was born in 1977. I was a young kid in the 1980s. I remember vaguely some of this stuff. And of course, I can read about it now as an adult. But there's something about this that I do think sort of rings somewhat true in the sense that the evangelical world stopped teaching dispensationalism. The fundamentalist world largely stopped teaching dispensationalism. In fact, I've heard stories, when I was doing research on O'Hare, I heard stories that when O'Hare died, there was a certain level of, from some people, that they didn't want to be a part anymore of the controversies that were being driven by fundamentalism, dispensationalism, and all that stuff. And there was a shift away from the teaching of doctrine and the teaching of prophecy and the teaching of the scripture towards a more touchy-feely, evangelicalism, like what Hummel is talking about, okay? But if scholastic dispensationalism was stumbling, self-inflicted wounds were only half the story. The decline of scholastic dispensationalism was also brought about by sharp criticisms leveled by fellow fundamentalists and evangelicals, covenantalists and neo-evangelicals, who were more committed than ever to cutting down dispensationalism influence in light of its growing mass and lay appeal. So now you're going to have the enemies of scholastic dispensationalism going to be attacking it theologically, philosophically. Now, these guys don't, make no mistake, they resent the fact that Lindsay has been able to capitalize on pop dispensationalism. They hate this, okay? But they're going to be able to sort of aim up and put scholastic dispensationalism into their crosshairs because of this, okay? A renewed vision of old premillennialism, going by the name historic premillennialism, flourished in the halls of new evangelical seminaries in the 1970s. In classrooms at Fuller Seminary, Gordon, Conwell Seminary, and Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, among others, centers of evangelical training. New evangelicals insisted that historic premillennialism was superior on theological and missional grounds, while the conservative wing of the Southern Baptist Convention also included historic premillennialists such as SBC president from 1982 to 1984, Jimmy Draper. The new Christian right also brought a prominent key historic premillennial social activist, including author and pro-life activist Francis Chafer and family values proponent James Dobson. both of whom rejected an imminent rapture and future kingdom as antithetical to urgent political organizing. Okay, so these are key guys now in the 90s. Schaefer, etc. Okay. Now, the most prominent figure in this anti-scholastic dispensational movement is going to be George Eldon Ladd, page 260. The most successful of these challengers was by far George Eldon Ladd, the Ernest Wilde dispensational seminary student in the 1930s, pioneer critic of dispensationalism in the 1940s and 50s, and professor of New Testament studies at Fuller Theological Seminary. As the banner carrier for historic premillennialism, Ladd enjoyed unprecedented success in evangelical circles in the 1970s. The definitive presentation of his method, A Theology of the New Testament, 1974, was ranked by evangelical seminaries 12 years later as the second most influential work of theology behind only Calvin's Institutes. As the theologian Russell Moore declared years later, Ladd was the chief scholarly influence behind the emerging evangelical consensus on historic premillennialism in the late 20th century. Now, Ladd is going to influence a lot of people, okay? Ladd is going to be sort of the one who puts in motion what will ultimately become progressive dispensationalism in the late 1980s or early 1990s. The most obvious difference between dispensational and historic premillennial movements in the 1970s was that the latter stayed relatively coherent while the former popularized rapidly. The relative stability and lack of popular growth in historic premillennialism initially alarmed its supporters, who regarded, quote, rapture theory and apocalyptic politics as poorly conceptualized and thought dispensationalism besmirched their own reputation for theological rigor and consistency. Basic errors of exegesis, he insisted, were endemic to dispensationalism and were only exacerbated by the imprecision of popular writings and willingness of theologians, supposedly fellow scholars, to wade into popular commercial writing. So Ladd is capitalizing on all of this. Okay, he writes Jesus and the Kingdom. Ladd proposed a synthesis of Protestant eschatology, citing favorably contemporary German theologians Werner Kummel and Gunther Brockmann, Dutch theologians Herman Ridgerboss, and American Presbyterian scholar J. Arthur Baird. Ladd evaluated American evangelical concerns, including the inerrancy of Scripture, but these did not quash his ability to draw from new academic and textual developments. While few Protestant theologians took much note of Ladd, Ladd's attention to them reshaped the scholarly landscape of evangelicalism. As early as 1967, Ladd observed from his admittedly motivated vantage that, quote, the successors to the fundamentalists of the 1920s have divided into two directions based on engagement with wider theological discussions. Some have showed little interest, indeed a strengthening negative attitude toward interacting with the mainstream of culture, philosophy, and theology, example dispensationalists, while others who possessed the same theological heritage of older fundamentalism were convinced of the truthfulness of the fundamentals of Christian faith, but did not reflect basic defensive apologetic stance of fundamentalism. A decade later, Ladd's words rang true to many observers, and acceptance or rejection of dispensationalism was one of the main fault lines of the division. So dispensationalism becomes a lightning rod here, okay? And Ladd is all too keen to sort of intellectually put dispensationalism to bed. At least that's what he's attempting to do. Dispensationalists and historic premillennialists disagreed over abstract, often minor theological points. The substance, however, was a battle over institutional power and the intellectual direction of the broader fundamentalist and evangelical movement. While once quite hospitable to scholastic dispensational influence, the same institutions in the 1970s were slipping further from its grasp. The rapid popularization of dispensationalism also ironically sowed the seeds of its theological decline. the consumer-oriented culture that dominated pop dispensationalism and increasingly evangelicalism, values like internal coherence and scholarly discourse, important cultural markers, and fundamentalism also declined. Creativity, accessibility, and innovation produced financial and cultural capital, and capital was what propelled books about the Bible or the Bible itself into American stores and compelled new and renewed faith commitments in American pews. For the popularizers of dispensationalism, the discarding of scholastic oversight and the flood of commercial success were for the best. Provisions by God to spread the gospel and through commercial success to multiply the church's efforts. For the scholastics themselves, they tried to trap academic and mass market interests alike. Their inability to perpetuate a strong intellectual defense of dispensationalism, nor to outperform the popularizers, spelled a worrying future. And then that brings us to dispensationalism after fundamentalism, which is the last subsection. Let me see what time it is here. Sorry about that. It was not until 1966 that Dallas Theological Seminary accepted its first black student. A few years later, with still only a handful of black students on campus, one of them asked John Walbert, the president, why there were not more, why there was not more concerted effort at recruiting eager black would-be seminarians. That student was Tony Evans, who would become the seminary's first black PhD recipient and a nationally known pastor and speaker. So Evans has a few things to say about this. In Evans's words, a culture of self-segregation without the overt rejection that, I can't pronounce this word, concretized the limited appeal of dispensationalism beyond white circles. So he's saying that, now I want to say this is an important comment. What Hummel is asserting here applies to seminarians. It does not apply to non-seminarians. There are a lot of black African-American saints that I know who are very much appreciative of dispensationalism, rightly dividing the word of truth, and understanding the Bible from a dispensational point of view. So some of what Hummel is saying, and one of my commenters, maybe it was Stephen Hayes, said that while Hummel, on the one hand, makes some good observations, his observations are only focused on academia. Okay? They're not focused on what is happening outside of academia, outside of the, you know, the ivory towers of Christian academia, and what's happening with people in, you know, believers in the streets and in the pews. I would say those people have, many of them have largely never left dispensationalism and left the, some of those things. Now, he does talk in here about a seminal book written by Sandine, Ernest Sandine, The Roots of Fundamentalism from 1970. Great book, have it on the shelf, used it in the Grace History Project. And this is how he ends chapter 15. Viewed from the vantage point of the history of dispensationalism, however, the line of significance was reversed. Fundamentalism became an influential subplot to the story of dispensationalism, one that both spurred its creation as a system and was leading to its demise. So check that out again. Fundamentalism became an influential subplot to dispensationalism. So that is subordinating fundamentalism under dispensationalism, and it's saying that as dispensationalism grew, the fundamentalist movement took off, and as dispensationalism waned, the fundamentalist movement began to decline. Sandine's history ended in 1930, so he could be forgiven for thinking less about subsequent generation of fundamentalists who shaped dispensationalism into a scholastic tradition. But his book's influence was felt precisely when the fate of mid-century dispensationalism was coming into view. Dispensational theology was in free fall, even as pop dispensationalism was conquering American culture. So again, a lot of Hummel's analysis is based on what is happening in ivory towers. So it's sort of a double-edged sword or a mixed bag, right? Because on the one hand, you do have pop dispensationalism taking off. There seems to be no doubt about that. But the decline of dispensationalism that he's talking about is from a scholastic vantage point, most notably through Dallas Theological Seminary. I would argue that the Berea Bible Society, later Grace School of Bible, Pastor Richard Jordan, that there have been many people who have taken up the mantle of dispensational theology that possibly was, you know, ceded to them by the decline of scholastic dispensationalism and have continued to teach at a popular level the principles of mystery and prophecy, Israel and the church, the rapture and the second coming, all of those things, without, I might add, the incessant date setting and headline reading that is so common within pop dispensationalism. So that brings us to an end of our analysis of chapter 15. Okay, we only have a few chapters left in the book to go through. Look for another video later this week, as I'm trying to do two a week so I can get done with this project before the end of the year. Listen, if you've never trusted Jesus Christ, if you've never relied exclusively on the shed blood of Jesus Christ on the cross, his death, his burial, his resurrection from the dead after 3 days and three nights as the only total complete payment for your sin, trust Jesus Christ today before it's everlasting too late. Stop relying in your works, your law keeping, your performance, your tithing, whatever it is that you think is going to make you right before God, and trust and rely exclusively on Jesus Christ and what he did for you on the cross. Trust Jesus Christ today before it's everlasting too late. Thanks for your attention, and we'll see you next time.